Welcome to Bite at a Time Books, where we read you your favorite classics one bite at a time. My name is Bree Carlisle, and I love to read, and wanted to share my passion with listeners like you. If you want to know what's coming next and vote on upcoming books, sign up for our newsletter at biteatatimebooks.com. You'll also find our new t-shirts in the shop, including podcast shirts and quote shirts from your favorite classic novels. Be sure to follow my show on your favorite podcast platform so you get all the new episodes. You can find most of our links in the show notes. But also our website, biteatatimebooks.com, includes all of the links for our show, including to our Patreon to support the show, and YouTube, where we have special behind the narration of the episodes. We're part of the Bite at a Time Books Productions Network. If you'd also like to hear what inspired your favorite classic authors to write their novels, and what was going on in the world at the time, check out the Bite at a Time Books Behind the Story podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts. Please note, while we try to keep the text as close to the original as possible, some words have been changed to honor the marginalized communities who've identified the words as harmful, and to stay in alignment with Bite at a Time Books' brand values. Today we'll be continuing Les Misérables by Victor Hugo. Chapter 6. Who guarded his house for him? The house in which he lived consisted, as we have said, of a ground floor and one story above, three rooms on the ground floor, three chambers on the first, and an attic above. Behind the house was a garden, a quarter of an acre in extent. The two women occupied the first floor. The bishop was lodged below. The first room, opening on the street, served him as dining room. The second was his bedroom, and the third his oratory. There was no exit possible from this oratory, except by passing through the bedroom, nor from the bedroom without passing through the dining room. At the end of the suite in the oratory, there was a detached alcove with a bed, for use in cases of hospitality. The bishop offered this bed to country curates whom business of the requirements of their parishes brought to D. The pharmacy of the hospital, a small building which had been added to the house and abutted on the garden, had been transformed into a kitchen and cellar. In addition to this, there was in the garden a stable, which had formerly been the kitchen of the hospital, and in which the bishop kept two cows. No matter what the quantity of milk they gave, he invariably sent half of it every morning to the sick people in the hospital. "I am paying my tithes," he said. His bedroom was tolerably large and rather difficult to warm in bad weather, and wood is extremely dear at D. He hit upon the idea of having a compartment of boards constructed in the cowshed. Here he passed his evenings during seasons of severe cold. He called it his winter salon. In this winter salon, as in the dining room, there was no other furniture than a square table in white wood, and four straw-seated chairs. In addition to this, the dining room was ornamented with an antique sideboard, painted pink in watercolors. Out of a similar sideboard, properly draped with white napery and imitation lace, the bishop had constructed the altar which decorated his oratory. His wealthy penitents and the sainted women of D had more than once assessed themselves to raise the money for a new altar for Monseigneur's oratory. On each occasion, he had taken the money and had given it to the poor. "The most beautiful of altars," he said, "is the soul of an unhappy creature consoled in thanking God." In this oratory, there were two straw prie-dieu, and there was an armchair also in straw in his bedroom. When, by chance, he received seven or eight persons at one time, the prefect, or the general, or the staff of the regiment in garrison, or several pupils from the little seminary, the chairs had to be fetched from the winter salon in the stable, the prie-dieu from the oratory, and the armchair from the bedroom. In this way, as many as 11 chairs could be collected for the visitors. A room was dismantled for each new guest. It sometimes happened that there were 12 in the party. The bishop then relieved the embarrassment of the situation by standing in front of the chimney if it was winter, or by strolling in the garden if it was summer. There was still another chair in the detached alcove, but the straw was half gone from it, and it had but three legs, so that it was of service only when propped against the wall. Mademoiselle Baptistine had also in her own room a very large easy chair of wood, which had formerly been gilded and which was covered with flowering Pekin. But they had been obliged to hoist this bergère up to the first story through the window, as the staircase was too narrow, It could not therefore be reckoned among the possibilities in the way of furniture. Mademoiselle Baptistine's ambition had been to be able to purchase a set of drawing room furniture in yellow Utrecht velvet, stamped with a rose pattern and with mahogany in swan's neck style, with a sofa. But this would have cost 500 francs at least, and in view of the fact that she had only been able to lay by 42 francs and 10 sous for this purpose in the course of 5 years, she had ended by renouncing the idea. However, who is there who has attained his ideal? Nothing is more easy to present to the imagination than the bishop's bedchamber. A glazed door opened on the garden. Opposite this was the bed, a hospital bed of iron with a canopy of green serge. In the shadow of the bed, behind a curtain, were utensils of the toilet, which still betrayed the elegant habits of the man of the world. There were two doors, one near the chimney opening into the oratory, the other near the bookcase opening into the dining room. The bookcase was a large cupboard with glass doors filled with books. The chimney was of wood, painted to represent marble and habitually without fire. In the chimney stood a pair of fire dogs of iron, ornamented above with two garlanded vases, and flutings which had formerly been silvered with silver leaf, which was a sort of episcopal luxury. Above the chimney piece hung a crucifix of copper, with the silver worn off, fixed on a background of threadbare velvet in a wooden frame from which the gilding had fallen. Near the glass door, a large table with an inkstand, loaded with a confusion of papers and with huge volumes. Before the table, an armchair of straw. In front of the bed, a prie-dieu borrowed from the oratory. Two portraits in oval frames were fastened to the wall on each side of the bed. Small gilt inscriptions on the plain surface of the cloth at the side of these figures indicated that the portraits represented 1. The Abbé of Chaliet, Bishop of St. Claude. The other, the Abbé Tortio, Vicar General of Agde, Abbé of Grand Champ, Order of Citeaux, Diocese of Chartres. When the bishop succeeded to this apartment, after the hospital patients, he had found these portraits there and had left them. They were priests and probably donors. Two reasons for respecting them. All that he knew about these two persons was that they had been appointed by the king, the one to his bishopric, the other to his benefice. On the same day, the 27th of April, 1785, Madame Magloire, having taken the pictures down to dust, the bishop had discovered these particulars written in whitish ink on a little square of paper yellowed by time, and attached to the back of the portrait of the Abbé of Grand Champ with 4 wafers. At his window, he had an antique curtain of coarse woolen stuff, which finally became so old that in order to avoid the expense of a new one, Madame Magloire was forced to take a large seam in the very middle of it. The seam took the form of a cross. The bishop often called attention to it. "How delightful that is," he said. All the rooms in the house, without exception, those on the ground floor as well as those on the first floor, were whitewashed, which is a fashion in barracks and hospitals. However, in their latter years, Madame Magloire discovered beneath the paper which had been washed over paintings, ornamenting the apartment of Mademoiselle Baptistine, as we shall see further on. Before becoming a hospital, this house had been the ancient parliament house of the bourgeois, hence this decoration. The chambers were paved in red bricks, which were washed every week, with straw mats in front of all the beds. Altogether, this dwelling, which was attended to by the two women, was exquisitely clean from top to bottom. "This was the sole luxury which the bishop permitted," he said. "That takes nothing from the poor." It must be confessed, however, that he still retained from his former possessions 6 silver knives and forks and a soup ladle, which Madame Magloire contemplated every day with delight as they glistened splendidly upon the coarse linen cloth. And since we are now painting the Bishop of D, as he was in reality, we must add that he had said more than once, "I find it difficult to renounce eating from silver dishes." To this silverware must be added 2 large candlesticks of massive silver, which he had inherited from a great aunt. These candlesticks held 2 wax candles and usually figured on the bishop's chimneypiece. When he had anyone to dinner, Madame Magloire lighted the 2 candles and set the candlesticks on the table. In the bishop's own chamber, at the head of his bed, there was a small cupboard, in which Madame Magloire locked up the 6 silver knives and forks and the big spoon every night. But it is necessary to add that the key was never removed. The garden, which had been rather spoiled by the ugly buildings which we have mentioned, was composed of four alleys in cross form, radiating from a tank. Another walk made the circuit of the garden and skirted the white wall which enclosed it. These alleys left behind them four square plots rimmed with box. In three of these, Madame Magloire cultivated vegetables. In the fourth, the bishop had planted some flowers. Here and there stood a few fruit trees. Madame Magloire had once remarked, with a sort of gentle malice,
"Monseigneur, you who turn everything to account have nevertheless one useless plot. It would be better to grow salads there than bouquets."
"Madame Magloire," retorted the bishop, "you are mistaken. The beautiful is as useful as the usual," he added after a pause. "More so, perhaps." This plot, consisting of three or four beds, occupied the bishop almost as much as did his books. He liked to pass an hour or two there, trimming, hoeing, and making holes here and there in the earth, into which he dropped seeds. He was not as hostile to insects as a gardener could have wished to see him. Moreover, he made no pretensions to botany. He ignored groups and consistency. He made not the slightest effort to decide between tournefort and the natural method. He took part neither with the buds against the cotyledons nor with Jussieu against Linnaeus. He did not study plants. He loved flowers. He respected learned men greatly. He respected the ignorant still more. And without ever failing in these two respects, he watered his flower beds every summer evening with a tin watering pot painted green. The house had not a single door which could be locked. The door of the dining room, which, as we have said, opened directly on the cathedral square, had formerly been ornamented with locks and bolts, like the door of a prison. The bishop had had all this ironwork removed, and this door was never fastened, either by night or by day, with anything except the latch. All that the first passerby had to do at any hour was to give it a push. At first, the two women had been very much tried by this door, which was never fastened. But Monseigneur de D had said to them, "Have bolts put on your rooms if that will please you." They had ended by sharing his confidence, or by at least acting as though they shared it. Madame Magloire alone had frights from time to time. As for the bishop, his thought can be found explained, or at least indicated, in the three lines which he wrote on the margin of a Bible. "This is a shade of difference. The door of the physician should never be shut. The door of the priest should always be open." On another book entitled Philosophy of the Medical Science, he had written this other note, "Am not I a physician like them? I also have my patients, and then too, I have some whom I call my unfortunates." Again he wrote, "Do not inquire the name of him who asks a shelter of you. The very man who's embarrassed by his name is the one who needs shelter." It chanced that a worthy curé, I know not whether it was the curé of Collabrue or the curé of Pompieri, took it into his head to ask him one day, probably at the instigation of Madame Magloire, whether Monseigneur was sure that he was not committing an indiscretion, to a certain extent, in leaving his door unfastened day and night, at the mercy of anyone who should choose to enter, and whether, in short, he did not fear lest some misfortune might occur in a house so little guarded. The bishop touched his shoulder with gentle gravity and said to him, "Nisi dominist custodiet domum, in vanum vigilant qui custodiet iam." Unless the Lord guard the house, in vain do they watch who guard it. Then he spoke of something else. He was fond of saying, "There is a bravery of the priest, as well as the bravery of a colonel of dragoons. Only," he added, "ours must be tranquil."
Thank you for joining Bite at a Time Books today, while we read a bite of one of your favorite classics. Again, my name is Brie Carlisle, and I hope you come back tomorrow for the next bite of Les Misérables. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter at biteatatimebooks.com and check out the shop. You can check out the show notes or our website, biteatatimebooks.com, for the rest of the links for our show. We'd love to hear from you on social media as well. Thank you.
time.